3677 United States versus Hill and Tello. Mr. Handelsman, hi, come on up.
I'm missing somebody.
I wasn't sure whether I was going first or co-counsel.
I have you. Who wants to go?
She wants me to go first.
Okay. You have 5 minutes. Ms. Bensky has six. You have two rebuttal. Ms. Bensky has two rebuttal.
May it please the court, Robert Handelsman for Tello. Any kind of RICO conviction requires two predicate acts. For substantive RICO, the commission of two acts must be shown. For RICO conspiracy, an agreement to commit two acts must be shown. Excuse me. The indictment alleged two acts to which Tello agreed, the Carmona and Espinoza shootings. There's no problem there. But the plea agreement alleged only one, and that's our problem.
How did everybody miss this?
The record doesn't show. I heard something from defense counsel. I don't know if I should repeat it here.
But I mean, it's a massive conspiracy.
Is it in the record? If it's not in the record, we...
No, it's not. It's not in the record.
I mean, we've got how many defendants in this indictment?
Well, there were Tello was number 45, but I couldn't tell you what happened here. That's why we're all here today. The sexual assault cannot count as a predicate act.
I kept wondering what courtroom was big enough to hold them all, but go ahead.
The sexual assault cannot count as a predicate act because, one, there was no evidence that such assaults were a means by which the enterprise was conducted.
Yeah, but even if we were to agree with your point about the sexual assault not qualifying as a predicate act, the government in its factual proffer said it expected the trial evidence to include proof of two murders. So why wouldn't the two murders be consistent with the predicate acts alleged in the indictment and sufficient to establish Mr. Tello's guilt of RICO conspiracy?
Because the two shootings that are alleged in the indictment were Carmona and Espinoza. But Espinoza was not alleged in the plea agreement. You only have one predicate act in the plea agreement. That's the problem. There's no problem with the indictment. If the plea agreement or the plea procedure duplicated the indictment, we wouldn't be here today. You'd have an Anders brief.
Right. This is the Bradley case.
That's precisely it. This is almost all fours on Bradley. The only difference is that Bradley was not a plain error case. But Bradley speaks about how the failure to put the alleged predicate act in the plea agreement adversely affects the defendant's substantial rights. And that's precisely what we're talking about here.
Was there anything in the plea colloquy that fixed the defect in the plea agreement?
I don't recall any. The government doesn't say there was. During the break, I'll take a look through there and see if there was something. But I don't recall that. And quite frankly, if there was, I don't know I haven't seen any cases that say if the plea agreement is defective, you can fix it up with the plea colloquy. I guess conceivably it could under Van and other cases.
Yeah, you could probably get everybody to agree on the record.
Yeah. But I don't think that was done. What the government does here is they talk about, well, there was relevant conduct and he did a lot of bad things, but that's really irrelevant here because unless those bad things are in the indictment and the plea agreement, the whole process fails.
Yeah, but could I go... I want to go back to the bottom line here, which is, given our holding in Campione, that RICO conspiracy does not require an agreement as to which two predicate acts will be committed, what is the plain error here?
The plain error, Neapolitan says that if it's not in the indictment, it's worthless. It cannot be used to support a RICO conviction. The sexual assault is not in the indictment.
And that's for a RICO conspiracy claim, too.
Well, a RICO conspiracy is an agreement to commit two predicate acts. As I said before, and I said in the reply brief, the indictment is fine. There's no problem there. It comes in with the plea agreement, which has only one act.
Right. The argument that's being made is that there's a distinction between a substantive RICO claim and a RICO conspiracy claim with respect to this issue of agreement between the indictment and the proofs or the indictment and the plea agreement. And the question is whether that distinction in the claims or in the offenses, the substantive RICO offense and the conspiracy, the inchoate RICO offense, whether that makes a difference.
Well, the agreement, there has to be an agreement to commit two acts, but only one is alleged in the plea agreement. That's the problem.
Well, there are two, but one has no counterpart in the indictment.
Well, they pled guilty to count two, which incorporates count one. But as I recall the plea agreement, it just mentions the Carmona shooting.
Right, one of the homicides that's mentioned in the indictment, and then the sexual assault.
The sexual assault is not alleged in the indictment, so it can't be considered. That's the whole point here.
So the bottom line is the factual basis for the plea agreement is missing, and so the plea is not knowing and voluntary.
Right, just like it was in Bradley. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Spensky, good morning.
May it please the Court, I represent Defendant Appellant Kenneth Hill. This is the second time Mr. Hill's case is in the Court of Appeals. And the reason we're here is because the government improperly used the mistake of the first remand as an excuse to open issues that it had completely waived the first time around.
Now, assuming we did get past the waiver question, why couldn't the Court find that he was an accessory of the fact, given his second-in-command status with the gang, his admitted role in storing firearms for other gang members? I mean, despite the lack of direct evidence that he knowingly accepted the murder weapon for storage, couldn't one reasonably infer that he knowingly accepted the gun in order to keep the police from discovering it?
The judge didn't find those specific facts, and they needed to. The judge did not discuss the elements. What the judge did find was that he concealed the weapon, and that was based on the fact that I think the quote was, people know things when you're in a gang. It was very general. And the court did not discuss the elements of being an accessory after the fact. You have a crime against the United States has to be committed, and we don't dispute that. But the defendant has to know at the time that a crime against the government has been committed, and there's nothing in the record that he knew at the time that the weapon was concealed in his apartment that it had been used to commit some sort of crime against the United States. The judge didn't go through the elements of that offense at all. But getting back to the waiver issue, I don't think that we can get past the waiver issue because of this court's opinion in United States v. Wilson, and the government didn't even address it in their briefs. And I read that case 7 or 8 times, and unless I'm really missing something, I can't find any way to distinguish Wilson. In that case, there was money laundering and mail fraud counts that had been not grouped together, and when they went back, the judge and the probation office and the government said, well, now we're allowed to use the money laundering or mail fraud as relevant conduct. And coming back to this court said, absolutely not. Nobody had mentioned the first time around that the mail fraud could be relevant conduct to the money laundering. They could have brought it up at the first sentencing. They didn't. The issue was waived. That ship has sailed. And
did Mr. Hill's counsel object to the new enhancement?
defense counsel did not object on this particular basis, but the defendant did. Right after the government filed its supplemental sentencing memorandum, the defendant actually wrote a letter saying, I object to this, and then he explained in kind of stilted language that the reason we're here is to address my 1998 conviction, which was explicitly part of the court's mandate. And he said, that's the reason we're here for resentencing. So it was definitely brought up.
Is that in the record?
Yes, it is. It is document 1793. And what he says on the second page, he talks about his recklessly endangering safety conviction, and then, quote, which is the sole purpose I'm here to be resentenced. And in PACER, it's listed as an objection, so even though it did come from the defendant directly, the court considered it.
Did he talk about that in his allocution?
I don't believe that he brought the point up that the government waived the issue. But even if we were looking at this under a plain error standard, plain error clearly applies here. There was an error and it was plain. U.S. v. Jumah, J-U-M-A-H, 599 F3rd 799, page 813, says that plain error exists and remand is proper when a sentence is based on a miscalculation of the guideline range. So there was an error, it was plain.
What's the difference in the range?
102 months. So without that accessory after the fact enhancement, he would have guidelined at 46 to 57 months, but he had a 924C as a predicate act, so he was at 5 years.
5 year minimum, what's the maximum?
Well, the guidelines just say that when there's a statutory minimum, that's the guideline. So it doesn't give a range.
But what's the maximum?
The statutory maximum on that?
I mean, the judge could have issued this sentence as a matter of his Booker discretion, right?
Right, he could have, but it wouldn't have enjoyed a presumption of reasonableness, so he would have had to explain why he was raising the defendant.
Oh, but there's boatloads of stuff here that would justify this sentence as a matter of Booker discretion had that record been made. Assuming this is within the statutory maximum, which apparently it is.
Right, and I don't recall what the statutory maximum is for that. I can certainly supplement this. But
we can figure it out.
The point is that the record as it is right now would not justify an expansion of 102 months. And regardless, even with the Booker discretion, the judge has to start with a properly calculated guideline sentence no matter what. Thank you.
Mr. Gonzalez, you're going to start with Tello, or are you going to start with Phil?
May it please the Court. My name is Mario Gonzalez. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I'm going to start with I'll address Tello first, but I'm going to address some of the questions that the Court raised earlier. There was 49 defendants listed in this indictment. There were several parallel indictments that increased the number into the mid-50s. The issue as to why the two predicate acts were not included in the plea agreement, I believe counsel indicated that Mr. Tello agreed to the two. He did not agree to the two. There was the problem. He agreed to the first, the Carmona shooting. He did not agree to the Espinoza shooting initially. So the government was either going to try the case in Mr. Espinoza in regards to Mr. Espinoza, or they were going to include it in the plea agreement as we did, as indicating that we were going to continue to litigate that issue for the court to make a determination whether that conduct, the predicate act, could be included in the sentencing calculation, and that was included in the plea agreement. So the defendant pled guilty. He was the government and the defendant agreed that we would litigate this issue. Randa had an evidentiary hearing. Mr. Espinoza came and testified. He implicated Mr. Tello as the person who shot him in the head. indicated that prior to that shooting there was gang-related words spoken to him prior to being shot. He was shot. The court
that
considered
that shooting isn't the problem here. It's the sexual assault.
The sexual assault was included at the request of the defendant, Mr. Tello. I don't know if that's in the record, but the defendant wanted that included as part of the relevant conduct. And I guess my understanding was that he wanted to argue that because it was relevant conduct or because it was part of the conspiracy, that it wouldn't score for criminal history category points.
Right. None of that makes any difference as far as the factual basis for the plea is concerned. What we're concerned with is the disconnect between the indictment and the factual basis for the plea.
Well, the plea agreement indicates that the matter was going to be litigated. It was litigated before the district court. The district court addressed that prior to sentencing in the sentencing transcript.
That doesn't make a difference if it's not in the indictment.
The sexual assault allegation.
Right.
But the two predicate acts were included in the indictment, and they were considered by the court.
Right. But the question is not the sufficiency of the indictment. It's the sufficiency of the factual basis of the plea. We need two predicate acts to support the plea to the conspiracy count. We only have one that has any relationship to what's in the indictment, and under the Bradley case and the Napolitano case, that's an insufficient factual basis.
The Bradley case addresses a 924C allegation where the government switched the basis for the predicate basis for that offense. In this case, there is no requirement that the government, as the court noted earlier, there is no requirement that the government prove two predicate acts. It's a requirement under Glazier, Napolitan, Quintanilla, that the government is only required to prove that there was an agreement that crimes would be committed by any of the co-conspirators on behalf of the conspiracy itself. And in this case, in the factual basis, the defendant agrees that there...
Napolitano says that you need a charge in proof of two specified predicate crimes for the conspiracy.
For the conspiracy count under subsection 1962D?
Yes, that's what the case says. That's a conspiracy. So for the inchoate crime, you need two predicate acts.
To be committed by the conspiracy.
Agreement to two predicate acts.
Not agreement that the... I guess I'm confused. There's no requirement that the defendant commit two acts in furtherance of the conspiracy. There's only a requirement that the conspiracy itself would commit at least two predicate acts.
I'm just reading from the case.
Okay.
Absent a charge and proof of an agreement to commit two of the specified predicate acts, and specified is highlighted, the defendant cannot be convicted of conspiring to participate in the affairs of an enterprise through a RICO pattern. So the disconnect makes a difference here, legally speaking.
As far as the inclusion in the factual basis, but the plea agreement and the defendant was aware that the two predicate acts for which he was charged in the indictment were presented to the court and considered by the court in making its determination as to sentence.
But that's not the right factual basis for the plea. The fact that it's relevant conduct that's a sentencing issue. That's not a criminal liability issue. We're talking about the sufficiency of the factual basis to find him criminally liable for the RICO. You needed to either get a superseding indictment that included the sexual assault or get his agreement to one of the other predicate acts in the indictment, I think, to fix it.
Well, I would argue that the factual basis includes language that the defendant agrees that he and others will commit will have committed two violations, and the factual basis for which he was sentenced on was that he didn't agree to the Espinoza shooting. That issue was litigated to determine, and the sole basis was to determine whether the court could consider that as a sentencing factor.
Right. What comes in for sentencing purposes is entirely distinct from the factual basis for the plea. Is there anything other than the one shooting that he pled to as a predicate act?
That he pled to?
That he pled to. That he agreed.
The Carmona shooting was the only one that he agreed to. He agreed to have the judge make the determination as to the second predicate act. That's why we
but
had the evidence.
But that wasn't in the indictment.
That was in the indictment. The second shooting was in the indictment, the Espinoza shooting. And that was litigated by Judge Randa. He made the determination that
Well, that gets to the question that I asked initially about whether there was something in the plea colloquy that overrode what was in the plea agreement or amended what was in the plea agreement. Now, you're telling me that there was something in the plea colloquy where he agreed that the second shooting would be considered as part of the factual basis?
I don't know if it was directly addressed. The plea colloquy that this issue remained litigated, the judge went over the fact that if you reviewed the plea agreement, you agree there's a factual basis for it, which is the factual basis.
So he didn't admit to the second shooting?
He didn't admit to the second shooting with the understanding that that would be litigated and the determination would be made by the court as to the second
shooting. At sentencing?
Prior to sentencing.
I'm so confused.
So he didn't admit to the second shooting.
He didn't admit to it. He agreed that the parties would litigate the issue.
That's not how pleas are taken. You don't litigate things at the plea stage. They're either admitted or they're not admitted. And if you're going to litigate something, you got to try the case, right?
I was more than prepared to try the case.
I get that part.
Let me ask a really simplistic question. The indictment set forth one set of predicate acts, right?
62 predicate acts.
You couldn't get him to agree to
one
more
set.
Than one of those.
We'll call it a set.
He.
And then the plea agreement and the plea colloquy altered the set of predicate acts?
The predicate acts were listed in the indictment. He did not want to plead. He wouldn't agree to the Espinoza shooting. At that point, at least one of the defendant had been convicted of racketeering murder and various offenses in an actual trial. He didn't want to go to trial. That case went to trial. There was a conviction in that case. He then said that he would agree that he was a member of this conspiracy, that members of the conspiracy committed acts in furtherance of the conspiracy, which is the general language that is listed in the plea agreement, in the plea colloquy. But he said as to the shooting of Mr. Espinoza, that predicate act, he couldn't agree to it, and he wanted to see the government's witnesses. The reason he wanted to see the government's witnesses was because that case, the victim was shot in the head, was a Spanish speaker. There was little to no follow-up by the police department, and several years later, when the indictment came down, others implicated Mr. Espinoza, and that's how it was included in the indictment. So it was charged many years after the fact as part of that. If I can, at this time, I'd just like to – I don't know how much time I have left, but I will – I'd like to address briefly the issue as to the remand on Mr. Hill's case. This court, when it remanded Mr. Hill's case, did not give specific parameters of that remand. It simply indicated that the sentence was vacated, he was sent to be resentenced, and that the court should take a look at some conduct should be considered for criminal history category points as relevant conduct.
Now, I'm having a terrible time with this because, to me, it kind of looks like a straightforward case of waiver. The career offender designation was disputed at the first sentencing, so surely the government appreciated that we might reverse on that issue on appeal, which, of course, would render other potential enhancements pertinent. So why wasn't the government obliged to raise the accessory after the fact reference at the first sentencing on penalty of waiver if it didn't? I mean, surely it's not the government's position, or maybe it is, that so long as we don't expressly restrict the scope of the resentencing, both parties are free to remand to raise any and all sentencing issues, regardless of whether they were, you know, originally raised.
The plea agreement and the negotiations of the party clearly, in paragraph 16 of the plea agreement, indicates that the defendant was a career offender. And that was what the parties negotiated for, that he would have a base offense level of 13 at the time
of
his plea.
All that means is you didn't need the accessory after the fact enhancement to get the exposure you wanted.
That is correct.
It doesn't mean that your waiver is excusable. You got to put everything on the table.
Well,
otherwise it's gone.
At the original sentencing, the court never even examined the underlying racketeering guideline. It used a totally different guideline. It used the career offender guideline, to which there wasn't the issue of accessory after the fact and the inclusion of that was not the guideline that the court was considering. The court was considering the accessory after the career offender guideline, and so the court on remand should be allowed to take a look at the complete application of the guideline, whether what enhancements and what sentence would reflect the conduct that was involved. The first time around, the court didn't do that. It simply applied the career offender guideline, which takes into account and punishes the defendant based on his prior criminal history, not necessarily on the underlying conduct for which he had pled guilty to and had taken responsibility for. So that it is the government's position that that because the court on the remand was now applying a completely different set of guidelines, that the court could reexamine its earlier position and sentence the defendant accordingly. The defendant...
Judge Randa could have come in with the same sentence on an exercise of Booker discretion without the newly raised and previously waived enhancement.
I guess I would dispute that it was newly raised. The characterization of it as being an accessory after the fact and the application of that guideline was newly raised, but the facts as they were presented in the pre-sentence report were the same facts as that were presented before. The fact that this murder occurred, that within a very short time period, within eight or so hours prior to the execution of the search warrant, the murder was committed, and then the following morning the gun was recovered from the residence.
Well, the facts may have been included in the pre-sentence, but the pre-sentence report itself didn't recommend the application of the accessory after the fact.
That's correct.
Enhancement, either in the original sentencing or on resentencing, frankly. This was an argument that the government came in with at the sentencing hearing.
That is correct.
So I'm not sure that the fact that the underlying facts were referred to in the original pre-sentence gets around the government's waiver.
But I think that the court, when it indicated that the judge could have sentenced Mr. Hill to the same sentence based on...
Right, but that's not the record we have right now.
Yeah.
That is correct. I can see my time is up. Thank you.
Randlesman, how much time? 1 minute.
I'll do my best. What the government is telling you is the defendant wouldn't agree to one predicate act, so they made up one. It's not in the indictment, not in the plea agreement.
Well, apparently there's a factual basis for it. So I'm not sure it's correct to say that it was made up. It's just that it's not related to anything that's in the indictment.
Well,
he didn't admit it. So.
Well, that's basically what I mean. They just pulled it out of thin air. Nobody's disputing that he didn't participate in a sexual assault.
He was convicted of it in state court.
Yeah, he was convicted of it in state court. But if it's not in the indictment, it's all irrelevant here. They basically made it up to try to fill in a gap so they wouldn't have to try the case. I don't know where I come from. You don't like the plea agreement? You go to trial. We don't make stuff up. I don't know Evidently, in Milwaukee, they do things differently. Now, out of the 62 predicate
That's
acts...
That's not fair, counsel.
You're treading on pretty rough ground there.
Well, at least in this situation. Out of the 62 predicate acts, there are only two to which Tello agreed. And if you can just bear with me, I looked at the transcript of the plea agreement and the text of the plea. You should have those. It says in the plea agreement, he agreed to commit at least two qualifying criminal acts. Keep talking about the Kings. Defendant admits to these facts, and these facts establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. There's a colon, and they list the Carmona shooting and the sexual assault. So, and there's absolutely nothing in the plea transcript. Thank you. Somebody left a brief up here.
Ms. Binsky, how much time?
Thank you. I just want to point out that the murder itself, to which Mr. Hill was accused of being an accessory after the fact, was not charged in the indictment. He was not charged in the indictment as being an accessory after the fact to murder. It was not a predicate act. And so the government waived the right to bring the issue at that point. As far as the finding of second in command was based upon improper testimony, because the government is not allowed to augment the record on appeal, particularly on an issue that they have waived, and that's what they did. So it was from the detective's testimony at that resentencing when that second in command finding was made, so that was improper. The remand did not specifically say you cannot go back and bring up relevant conduct that had been raised. But that's implicit in all remand orders. The U.S. v. Husband case says that the court does not remand issues that have been waived. So that's implicit in all remand orders. So there was a violation of the remand in addition to being a waiver. And as far as the plea agreement was a bit inconclusive about whether or not Hill was a career offender. In one section it said he agreed he was a career offender. Another section titled career offender said the defendant acknowledges that he may be a career offender. But regardless, it doesn't matter because after the plea agreement, before the first sentencing, he filed three briefs in the district court saying, I'm not a career offender, and the government should have at that point said, okay, but you're an accessory after the fact, because if the government had lost their career offender argument at that point, case closed. They wouldn't have been able to come to the Court of Appeals and say, well, I want to try again. So I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Case will be taken under advisement. You both.